Hello, and welcome to Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. I am one of your hosts, John McMahon, and joining me on the other line, the world is back in order. She feels so much better about life now that she's back playing racquetball with her bros. It's Danielle Hanley.
Oh, she's so happy that racquetball is back.
It is back. The great, our long national nightmare is over. Philip and Stan are playing racquetball, broing out, being overly competitive.
Wildly
Everything has snapped back into place.
Just all it took was 7 months and like a couple of murders.
7 months, couple of murders, trip to Epcot.
Casual. You know,
the Munchkins running the FBI. Stan being bad at his job. Yeah.
The Munchkins running. That's like borrowed nostalgia for the 1930s.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Oh, we're back. Back with another episode.
So, Danielle, I watched The Killer last night. Happy New Year. The listeners will hear this in like 3.5 or 4 months, yeah. But Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
My New Year's Eve, I watched The Killer. So I'm going to try to bring commenting on David Fincher energy to this podcast.
Great. The real, like,
Sickos
embracing embracing your CR soul.
Yeah.
I love.
Joined the army.
I love. What are we doing here today, John?
Who knows? I think we're talking about The Americans, season 4, episode 9, The Day After. Just kidding. Daniel and I both have literally extensive notes. That's not a bit. Americans, season 4, episode 9, The Day After, written by Tracy Scott Wilson, directed by Daniel Sackheim. Danielle, what is our summary this week?
The IMDb summary of The Day After is, The Day After premieres, making the stakes and the terrible consequences of the Cold War plane. Even with that in mind, will Elizabeth be able to complete the painful process of the Patty operation? One of the least bad summaries?
Yes. I am not a fan of this switch in season 4 to like all of the IMDb summaries being question marks at the end.
Yeah.
But sometimes you gotta roll with it.
Listen, this is the least offensive question we've had all season. So like... I'll take it. Wasn't last episode like, this is an episode of The Americans, period. It's like the
last episode was the one where we speculated that it was written by ChatGPT before ChatGPT existed.
Yes, that's right. That's right. This one feels a little bit less ChatGPT and a little bit more like two people wrote the two different sentences.
It's giving student voice writing a paper that it like is
or like student copied half their homework from the friend and then tried to do the other half themselves. Oh my god. I mean, I don't give homework, so
yeah, homework, what is that? Actually, that's not true. There was like homework, I guess, in when I teach the first year seminar.
That's like
go to office hours with student hours with your professors. That's that kind of stuff.
It's like action items so that you cosplay being a student before you know how to be a student.
Honestly, that's how I should sell it to them when I teach this class again.
Listen, you're what?
TM.
Take it.
Danielle Hanley, January 1st, 2024. She got it in early.
Right at the jump of the year.
The problem is when this doesn't get released for many months and then someone else beats you to it. They're going to trademark that shit first.
Listen, what can you do? Like, we stick to a schedule here. We can't be bothered by
it's me. I'm trying to put myself in the role of a listener, especially if the listener doesn't actually know us, to be like, what are these two fuckers saying about sticking to a schedule? Like, random months-long breaks in episode drops, episodes that last somewhere between an hour and 25 minutes and 7 hours, like...
I have faith in us today of getting in under an hour and a half. So let's get rolling.
You should have told me that.
Get up, sit up, let's go.
Good thing we don't have a lot of possible digression areas in borrowed nostalgia. Okay, I think for the main discussion, though, the way to frame this episode The Day After is thinking about obligation. I've actually ended up reading a lot about political obligation recently for reasons I don't quite know why. I think it had something to do with, like, teaching environmental political thought. Yeah. And then, like, that Davina Cooper bug is also interested in ovulation. Yeah. Kind of obliquely. But anyway, that's been on our brains. And I think that, because everything I read, I just assume is
Daniel's said brains as though we don't share one.
Great point. note taken and accepted. And so I think that the way to think about this episode in obligation is one in which all of the main characters and maybe some of the like secondary characters of the Americans are dealing with questions about to whom or to what or to what multiple things and people their obligations might lie. And I think this is an episode in particular, Danielle, that asks questions about what happens when people in general or these particular characters of the Americans do when their obligations to themselves and their sense of self to others, and particularly the others that are close to them, and then like whatever external figure from which they're identifying like some important source of existence. And in the Americans, it's the nation. What happens when the obligations to those things are not quite aligned? And like, I think we see that with regards to Elizabeth and the Yankee operation.
Yeah.
William and Philip, like, are very explicitly, and thus bringing in Elizabeth to very explicitly, like, have that conversation. There's a way in which that's working for Paige. So where should we start in our discussion of obligation?
I think we start with Yankee, like, Elizabeth and the Yankee operation, because that is the place where these questions get opened up. And like, that's the thing that kind of comes back again and again in the episode, right? It like comes back in the William and Philip conversation. Like, it comes back a lot of times. So I think we start there. And I think in terms of the Yankee operation, we start with the Dawn encounter and its aftermath, right?
Sure.
Because I think that's probably the most intense version of these questions arise, like with regard to Dawn. It's like, Elizabeth, at least affectively, does not want to do this. And yet she says to Philip, like, no, it's fine. I'll do it. Right.
Yeah.
And so she first agrees to like watch the kids, which is a wild thing in general. And they're like, this random person.
Although, like, they've been quote unquote friends for 8 or 9 months at this point, and seemingly like Elizabeth and Yankee hang out all the time.
Yeah, but like,
Elizabeth has no other missions, right?
I guess like this is just a place where it is tough for me to wrap my head around it, in part because I'm from a really big family and like my parents were never letting someone who like wasn't related to us like watch us overnight, right?
Yeah. Although actually this makes me think, I guess the show does a good, like a quick and efficient making sense of this in the universe of the show, because the conversation at the beginning includes that, I forget if it's Dawn's mom or Yankee's mom. I think Yankee's mom, who like has back to Korea for her like yearly month long visit. So like the familial babysitting is not available.
Right. And so regardless, Elizabeth as Patty,
an hour and a half,
is like, oh yeah, we are like, I guess, like I'll watch the kids, no problem. They take off, and then Elizabeth proceeds to search the entire house, and she's looking for some evidence that like there's something that they can have on Dawn to be able to get the access that they need.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for blackmail. Yeah,
yeah. She goes through every single thing. And like meticulously, which we'll talk about a little bit later, she finds a porn tape, right? And that's like the only thing she finds. And
in like a generic like golf or tennis, like VHS cover.
Then it's like, okay, well, what do we do with this? Eventually, Yankee and Dawn come back. She calls like Dawn, I guess she calls Yankee. Knowing that Yonghee's not there, ends up talking to Dawn. He comes to help her, like, pick her up after, I don't know, some, like...
She gets dumped at a restaurant.
Date, in quotation marks. It's so perfectly scripted, right? It's like, this is the, like, all of the pieces are in place for her to seduce Dawn. And he's not, like, super picking up on it. Ask him if he wants wine in the middle of the day in her, like, weird apartment. He's like, okay. And then, like, eventually she comes on to him.
Well, and drugs him.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's the thing that, like, that was the interesting part for me, right? Like, so she drugs him so that she doesn't have to actually sleep with him, but she stages the scene so that it looks like they have slept together, so much so that she, like, jerks him off and, like, ostensibly he, like, comes on the blanket to yeah. show that, like, something has happened.
Yeah. So there's, I think, two things in there that are really crucial, especially for this question about obligation yeah. and, like, the conflicts that Elizabeth is feeling about those obligations, which are she knows that Young Hee's not home, right?
Yeah.
Like, her friendship with Young Hee, quote-unquote friendship, is strong enough so that she has a sense of where Young Hee would be at this given time and place
yeah.
for her ruse to work appropriately, and presumably has either learned enough about Don through interacting directly with him or through Young Hee that she assumes she can, like, get him to say yes to help her with this favor. So there's kind of one level at which she has to weaponize the, like, very closeness that has actually provided some sort of emotional solace for her. And then there's that second level where, like you pointed out, that she drugs Don so that she doesn't have to actually have sex with him. She doesn't want to, clearly, because right. of her relationship with Young Hee, and right. because she's expressed ambivalence about the, like, this gets back into our discussion in the previous episode about, like, how we use structure and abstraction to, like, put totally. Violence away, to, like, be in a position where she has to have sex she doesn't want to have, which is a very, like, mealy-mouthed, shitty way of saying that, but that's kind of, I think, how she experiences it. But anyway, so there's that part of it. But I also think on some level, she doesn't think that Don would actually have sex with her, right?
Which,
like, that's also the reading, which could be, like, a thing about, like, stereotypes about Asian masculinity and sexuality of Asian men, which could be a thing also about, like, oh. she knows via Young Hee that, like, Don actually is, like, very, very faithful, or is, like, very committed to her, or has some, like, respect for her friends, or whatever the case may be. But, like, I wonder if that, maybe this wouldn't work without the drugs, is also, so there's both the emotional tie and the practical tie, like, working together to amplify this conflict that she's feeling between her obligation to the mission and to the nation and her obligation to her, who she views as a friend of sorts.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I think that the tension between the obligation to the nation, the obligation to the friend, right? Like, the drugging is the thing that allows her to, like, maintain, at least, I think, in her mind, keep up her end of the obligation to each of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though she still, like, fucks over the husband, which yeah. is a, like, and we see at the end of the episode where she has that, like, to me, like, very beautiful moment where she's like, I'm gonna miss her, right? Like, even though she hasn't done the worst version of this
yeah.
in fulfilling her obligation to the nation, like, she has still sort of broken her obligation to the friend, but she's done it in such a way that it, like, it sort of, like, allows the landing to be softer. And I think that's interesting because Elizabeth as a character is not someone for whom the soft landing has ever been an important thing.
Yeah. And it's a role reversal in that sense for her, because usually yeah. it is her offering the soft landing to Philip
yeah.
to use that language. But here, Philip offers her the soft landing, right? It's Philip who says, maybe you don't actually have to do this. We should just tell the center that, like, this isn't going to work. We need another way in. And Elizabeth, like, at first assumes that that's Philip, like, not wanting her to do it for his sake. But he has to
yeah.
then point out to her, no, I'm saying that because you don't want to do
yeah.
this to
yeah.
he, right? So there's a sense in, like, Elizabeth has been so split or severed from some, like, emotional core of herself
yeah.
that, like, that obligation to the nation is so strong. The, like, affective and, like, psychoanalytic ties to it are so deep that, like, she needs to have Philip play this role that's the role reversal and then be extremely explicit about doing that and about how that's functioning.
Well, and I think it's really interesting, and we talked about this a little bit last time, but, like, last episode, and although this is 7 months ago or so, right?
Yeah.
But last episode is the first time where we hear mention of Gregory, who was kind of the last person that Elizabeth had, like, any sort of emotional tie with, right? like, we get this mention of Gregory, and now with Young Hee, and Young Hee's in the last episode too, where we're seeing that friendship continue to develop. And so I think it's incredibly interesting that, I think that you're right, that there is a severing that Elizabeth, like, that has happened for Elizabeth with regard to emotional ties. And for her, the entry in of emotional, of the emotional ties complicates the obligation that she has to the nation. And that is a thing that for Elizabeth for so long was so uncomplicated. Even the page stuff, and I think there's a connection here, another connection I want to get back to in a second, but even the page stuff for Elizabeth, the obligation to the nation has almost always trumped the obligation to her family. Not fully, right?
Yeah.
Because she's like, she's willing for a little bit of softness here and there. Like, she's like, oh yeah, we can't kill Pastor Tim. Which, side note, very sad. but... It's
and that's
like,
after being like, yeah, we're going to fucking kill Pastor Tim.
Right.
That's her first and second instinct.
Totally. The point that I wanted to come back to, though, is like the thing that you said earlier about the way Elizabeth experiences, like having sex that she doesn't want to have, right? Or being made to have sex that she doesn't want to have. I wonder how much of that, and this might be like subconsciously, or this might be under the surface somewhere, is also a question about not the obligation that she has to the nation, but the obligation that she's passing on to Paige to have to the nation, right? And I wonder, like, how much that comes into play or will come into play going forward as we think about, like, the way Paige has been, like, coerced into these obligations.
It's an excellent point, and I think it's not a coincidence that it is in season three, as things move towards progressing with Paige, that Elizabeth starts to like resent or like feel negative about the sex she has to have for her job.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the show gives us reasons separate from Paige that Elizabeth feels that way and has that experience. And also it's tied, I think you're right, to like the, what is she bringing Paige into question? And like, that makes me think that like, it's notable that this episode weaponizes the like familial friendship domesticity tie for the sake of blowing up the relationship with Young Hee.
Yeah.
By doing the babysitting. And like, we even get a camera shot that I think comments on this quite directly, where the first moment of Elizabeth like making sure the kids are asleep,
mm-hmm.
like it's a kid on a top bunk, we don't know that that's the case in immediately, and like there's no establishing shot of the room or anything like that, it's just a kid in a bunk, and like Elizabeth like rises up as if she's a horror movie villain over this child.
Oh, interesting.
And, like, I think that we get a little bit of like cinematic language to communicate the moral choices that are happening in this moment, like, and the use of that particular visual trope,
mm-hmm.
I think comments very effectively, like, on that conflict and on the like severity and depth of the bond that Elizabeth is breaking. Even if that bond was always extremely tenuous, always already tenuous.
I think that is an excellent point. I hadn't thought about the visual trope, but I think you're absolutely right. There's something about Elizabeth in the scenes, both with the kids and them in bed, but then also like in the places where she is looking for like dirt on Don, right?
Yeah.
There's something like incredibly horror movie-esque about it. And I experience that as like, oh God, like, are the kids going to catch her? Like, are they going to tell their parents? Right. Like, that suspense, but I think that you're right that the suspense is building, it's building suspense towards the shattering of the like friend/family relationship that she has established.
Yeah. Maybe one more note on Elizabeth and Young Hee that, and this is another way in which the show can sometimes be obvious, but not in an annoying way, that like the conversation that they have, that Young Hee and Elizabeth have, has to do about like punishment, harshness, like what are cultural or national or like social ways that children are raised vis-a-vis their parents.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, they're talking about you know, like being softer on kids in America or whatever. Yes, Yang He is talking about how she was raised differently. Her mother raised her differently. But also, like, the scene is just saturated with the fact that not Patty, but Elizabeth, right, has a child who she quasi-ignores and a child who she is eliciting into the world of becoming a spy. And, like, yeah, so Elizabeth is not, as far as we know, like, spanking her kids. But, like, we saw that emotionally violent, I think we agreed it was, like, yeah, outburst towards Paige in the previous episode.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's something, there's a parallel here, I think, between Young He and Paige, right? With the way that the relationship with Young He is unraveling in precisely the way that, like, it mirrors something that's happening with Paige and, like, with Paige, yeah, and Elizabeth. And I think, like, it's both of those relationships tell us something about Elizabeth's inability or, like, difficulty in making emotional connections, and then the consequences that come from that sort of difficulty and what happens as a result. It's not exactly, yeah, the same thing with Young He and with Paige, but, like, there's something happening there that feels, like, at least congruent.
It is, and I think that that's related to, you know, I was wondering, watching this episode, thinking about it, and then us talking about what we're going to do, like, maybe this is the thing that Elizabeth has least wanted to do,
I think,
mission-wise,
that's right,
in a long while, or maybe ever, that we've seen her. Like, yes, there is, like, forms of disobedience towards the center vis-a-vis Claudia in season two around how to, like, handle the Laric shit. But, and there's, like, the ongoing dialogue and debate about what to do about Paige, but there's something that emotionally is functioning different in this moment and in this mission. And you're pointing out, when we were chatting before the show, and then we started this, this part of our conversation, like, her just deep sadness and the, yeah, I'm going to miss her at the end, that I think communicates, like, something qualitatively distinct about this for Elizabeth.
I think that's absolutely right. And the only thing that I would add is that before, or in other instances where there's been some, like, let's call it, like, insubordination, right?
Yeah, that's the right term.
Good. It's like, I know better, or I know a better way to do this.
Yeah.
Because, like, and there's never a questioning of the commitment to the nation, right?
Great. Yep.
And this,
right,
is,
it's
not
a, I'm
that.
Doing better for the nation,
exactly,
by doing it my way. This is,
this
brilliant,
is not that. This is like, oh, I'm humaning in a way that I haven't humaned in a while. And, like, I'm starting to care less about any obligation I have to the nation. I haven't fully abandoned it, but it is no longer the only thing present in my life.
Can I segue this one?
Do it.
So, best, I think we turn to our two, we're willing to negotiate our obligations to the nation and be a little insubordinate kings, William and Philip.
Always.
Who, Philip, like, and Philip got proved right, his, like, insubordination, I'm just going to run with your phrase, vis-a-vis Martha, was the right thing to do, quote unquote, and, like, was objectively correct on the level of pure spycraft. Like, Martha was going to be found out, and it was the right time to get her to the Soviet Union. And so, like, Philip was vindicated in his last, like, opportunity to forsake his most technical form of obligation to the nation or to Gabriel or to the center, and thus honor his obligation to Martha as he understood it. And, like, here he and William are kind of discussing how far, if further than that one instance alone, that particular moment, like, how much more that bears, or how much further one can take that. Because, like, William is like, I don't want to tell the center about this new virus, yeah, on level 4. And then William says, look, didn't you just, like, disobey orders,
yeah,
and bring in your agent? And what would be different if we don't tell them about Lassa virus?
And it's like, there's something about all of this that, and you see it on Philip's face, which is like, oh, this is another time where, like, I've gotten too close and, like, fucked up. I have, yeah, like, said too much, because now William is trying to use that, like, vulnerable moment I had with him, like, to manipulate me. And
because as much as William sometimes plays the fool or the jester or the jokester, he's also a spy who has been a Soviet spy within, like, Fort Meade for over a decade.
Yeah. For a long time, he's like incredibly skilled. It's just like there was something about that exchange where I was like, oh no, like I wanted to be done with the like sloppiness of all the Martha stuff. William is a reminder that we're not done with it.
Yeah. And also the justification that William gives for not wanting to do this is notable, and I think notable in the context of this being the day after episode, in the context of a conversation that Oleg and Tatiana have. He's like, A, it's never enough. Like, nothing I do, we do, will ever be enough. And then the key line from him is, I don't trust us, right, with this Lassa virus, which is a version of disidentification from the nation or one's obligation to it, that, like, we could plot our characters like on a spectrum to that, like trusting their nation, like Elizabeth is over there, Gabriel's over there, Stan is over there in his own fucking way, mediocre at his job though he may be, right? Somewhere in like the middle zone we have Philip, and then the I'm quite skeptical of the nation and like concerned about what that means, and maybe we can have a little disobedience as a treat is like William. And then like somewhere between William and Philip is Oleg. So like all of our characters, and this is like, I think something notable that season four does in the back half. And like, I'm fine with saying this is a question that can continues past season four.
Yeah.
But this like, what do our shifting potential or not shifting feelings about the nation affect our like inner emotional lives, our relationships, how we act in the world, like becomes an increasingly prominent question for the show, I think.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Like not just in terms of the show, but like in terms of like the nation, regardless of what nation it is, the nation is not a fixed concept, right? Like this is
something. I thought you were going to do some 80s Cold War history, but then I remember that you're not John Keller.
I'm not John Keller. He will make an appearance via text a little bit later.
He sure will.
But I mean, like the point I'm trying to make is also a point about like the 80s Cold War and like detente and all of that, which is, but first, the nation is not a fixed concept. This is like, you and I teach American political thought at least sometimes. And so, like, well, you teach an African-American political thought class.
That's true. And that is American political thought. Is
and I teach students, my American political thought class as Black political thought. So, like, right? But, like the nation is not a fixed concept. And I think, like, it's interesting to think about that in the context of the Cold War and the context and like the shifting like power and place of the nation and the nation in like the USSR in conflict with the US, right?
Yes.
Like that, like none of these things are fixed. And the Cold War is a moment where like that presumed fixity is being, in particular in the 80s, is being challenged all the time, right? And so it makes sense that that question is going to stick with us for the next couple of seasons.
It's a question that gets amplified by the fact that the day after becomes the central framing device of this episode.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, note the timing of the conversation that Philip and Elizabeth have about whether William is correct. It's while Elizabeth is brooding or like having a lot of feelings after having watched the day after.
Yeah.
Right. And Philip uses this opportunity to suggest to her that William was right. And maybe this one time we don't report this back to the center. And Elizabeth both says, I understand that. I really do. And we have to do this anyway, because the US is amassing these weapons to use against us because they dropped the atom bomb twice. Right. Which is like, That's a true Soviet like talking point and a not wrong Soviet talking point throughout the entirety of the Cold War. Granted, have the Soviets like had nuclear weapons, like they would have used them as well. There's like a logic of fucking states being violent and all of that. But like this is actually like a true point.
I mean, Elizabeth said that and I was like, hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
Elizabeth watched Oppenheimer. She saw Oppenheimer.
So did we.
Are you going down the Amanda Dobbins path?
No.
Oppenheimer?
No, I just, like, I didn't experience that movie as, like, a historical thing. Right?
Okay.
Like, I experienced the movie as, like, as a movie and only a movie.
Yeah.
I wasn't, like, thinking about the history of it. I'm not going down the Amanda Dobbins path. Don't put that on me.
Oh, no. I actually enjoy Amanda Dobbins' Oppenheimer bit a great deal, primarily for how much Sean Fennessy
annoyed
by it.
You don't listen to the rewatchables, but Bill is always like, this would have been better as three episodes of a TV series, and it drives Sean crazy, and it's so funny.
Okay, I'll give him that.
Oh my god. Okay, more on William and Philip.
No, I have something that I want to ask you, but I will save it for the dossier.
Okay, let's maybe from William and Philip go to Paige.
Please.
If we're thinking about obligation and William and Philip are sort of in the, we'll call it the like obligation gray area, right? Paige also, I mean, the thing that's complicated about
that Tom Clancy novel.
What?
Trying to think, like, what would the obligation gray area be the name of? And I decided it was like a shitty Tom Clancy novel.
I'll take that. You know, Sean Hanley loves the Tom Clancy novel.
Look. 13-year-old John fucking loved his Tom Clancy novels, too. So, respect to Sean Hanley,
the dad
of the Not Quite Great Books podcast.
Yeah, I mean, obviously.
No offense to my dad.
Listen, my dad gets shouted out every episode. So, like, it's fine that he's the dad of the podcast. But I think with regard to Paige, like, I think she's also sort of in that gray area of obligation insofar as, like, it's not so clearly delineated what her obligation is to, or at least the way that she experiences it, right? Philip and Elizabeth are trying to train her to have an obligation to the nation, to the center. But, like, it's never explicit, right? Even the stuff with Pastor Tim is, like, that's reactionary. It's not like, here is us structuring your set of obligations. And so I think, like, there's something happening there with Paige that's maybe worth talking about.
I agree. And I think that that framing is helpful because I think one way to describe the dynamics of obligation that are put upon Paige are that Elizabeth and Philip are not clear about the, like, obligation to the nation that they are imposing on her.
Yeah.
What they are doing is substituting you have an absolute, ultimate and unquestioning obligation to us and to the family, like, as synecdoche or, like, as stand-in for the nation, right? So, like, there's an actual, like, pure identification, maybe conscious, maybe not, of at least Elizabeth more so than Philip, but ultimately both of them, between themselves and the nation vis-a-vis Paige. Like, they're just going to use themselves as that conduit or as that synecdoche for the nation until, or like, if they're ever able to bring Paige in deeper on a certain way to the Soviet Union or to, like, the ideology or to Marxism or to Marxism-Leninism or to whatever. So, like, I think there's an attempt to simplify the obligation, like, relationships for Paige, when in fact they're precisely as fucked up as you just identified. That actually, like, it's a manipulation of how obligation functions, and that actually Paige doesn't get to have, like, self-directed and clearly delineated senses of obligation, in part because, like, as you and I have been identifying, all of the people that she is in relation with, like, the maybe odd exception, but probably not, of Pastor Tim, like, view her as object rather than subject, or as instrument, like, to be placed into a network of obligations rather than someone who is self-determining obligations.
I like that. And I think, like, what the question of obligation lays bare with Paige is also something that, like, connects back to the stuff with Don and then Young Hee, which is, like,
ooh, yes, please.
Which is, like, what happens with regard to obligation when, like, someone is coerced into the, like, various choices, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, what is the relationship between coercion and obligation? And I think, like, that is a big question that, like, the way that you're talking about Paige lays bare, but I think that same question comes in with regard to Don and Young-hee too.
Oh, was someone reading the Leviathan today?
Someone was not, but like...
some New Year's hungover Leviathan reading?
Yeah, you know.
Casual.
Just me in the frontispiece all day, every day.
Oh,
that
man,
one's for the real heads. You know, that one, and you're not even hungover. That was for us.
What's not for us?
Touche.
What did you make of, like, this being the one where Paige learns to drive with Philip episode? How is that fitting into, like, these broader conversations that are happening?
Well, like, it feels like driving on the one hand and, like, in a number of ways. But driving is this sort of like mark of freedom, right? Like this, it's an action that people undertake that makes them feel free. But in reality, it is also a set of activities that is like laden with obligation, right? So it's like structured through obligation to like the state. With regard to licensing, obligation to, like, the other people on the road, obligation to the person in the car with you. The political theorist in me is like, Rousseau, forced to be free. Rousseau, forced to be free. Rousseau.
We can theory ship the social contract again. That's totally acceptable.
Always. No, but I think, like, driving is this, at least for me, driving is something that, like, always was a mark of freedom. And in this episode where there's so much about obligation, it's also a good reminder that, like, freedom in America, at least, is not, like, divorced from the concept of obligation.
Nice. I like that read. I think, like, the way that I would think about the driving question, although maybe that changes a little bit based on your reading, but like a question that I had, particularly when we get the scene cutting back and forth between Elizabeth snooping around Young-hee and Don's house, back and forth with Philip and Paige talking about the day after.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, why make this particular cutting back and forth decision, this particular editing decision? And then I like was thinking about it later and recalled that the open is cutting back and forth between Philip and Paige in the car, and Elizabeth is with Young-hee.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the episode, we get Elizabeth is like finishing the mission with Don,
mm-hmm.
and we're cutting back to like Philip letting Paige like drive the Camaro.
Yeah.
So in all of these instances, I think that they are like highlighting we are using this moment of potential bonding as a way of possibly like building some relationships that would include some obligations to one another. But to your point about the paralleling of Paige with what Elizabeth is doing to Young-hee throughout this episode, there's like the show is just depicting in the way that it is editing the impossibility of like that bonding being fully real or fully realized in the structures and the networks that these people are a part of. Because, well, let's hit you over the head with the fact that Elizabeth's closest bond outside of the family, or hypothetically closest bond outside of the family that's not like Gabriel or Zhukov, R.I.P. Zhukov, is like being blown up and obliterated in this particular episode. And we're going to make the editing choice to depict that extremely visually.
I love that. I think the only other thing I would add is, and this just like underscores some of the points that you're making, but like it was striking that Philip is like, let's go do more driving. And this is sort of after Paige has experienced the day after movie, right? And she's kind of sulking about. And Philip's like, let's go do more driving. And she's like, he's like, I'll let you drive the Camaro. And so it's like this very obvious moment of like baiting and manipulation. And she falls for it like hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the look on Holly Taylor's face when she, like, turns around to be, like, the Camaro.
Yeah.
Is, yeah, exactly that.
I do just want to add, before we move on from this, that it was very stressful for me watching Paige drive the Camaro. I was like, she's going to crash. It's going to be bad.
What was your learning how to drive scenario? Like, because you would have been the first of the Hanley children.
I was the first of the Hanley children. I went to driver's ed, so, like, in New York, you had to go to driver's ed to get your, I think, to get your license a year early. And because there are like so many kids in my family, it like was very helpful for me to have a car and to drive me and Kate to swim practice. But the like real thing that jumps in my mind is not necessarily learning to drive, but learning to drive stick. So I drove a Jeep Wrangler that was a stick shift. And so I remember my mom I already had my license at this point, but taking me to a parking lot to teach me how to drive stick. And it was like my high school parking lot, very much akin to like the way Philip is teaching Paige in the beginning. And then we were like driving around the block. And we kept driving past like this one person's house who was in my grade. And then her mother like thought that we were stalking her or something. So she followed us in her car back to the parking lot. And this was like someone who I was like friendly with, but it was like the person, this must have been senior year. And so the person had like kind of like taken the like less savory path, right? Like, maybe had like turned to like drugs and stuff. So I think the person's mother thought that like we were after her or something. And my mom is literally just trying to teach me how to drive my Jeep, which was a stick shift. And then after that, I like had to drive to the beach, which is a half an hour away. And like you have to take highways. But I had like, mom's like, okay, well, what a good time to practice driving stick. Like, good luck. And I was like, what? So that was my learning how to drive. Passed my driver's test on the first shot.
Same, but I don't know how to drive a manual. So,
I prefer it because I'm a control freak.
True. Presumably, the Camaro is a manual. I would assume.
No, like, I don't think so.
As a nice sports car.
I can't imagine that. I don't think that Philip is letting Paige drive it if it's a manual.
That's precisely my question. Cause like we see that the like station wagon or whatever is an automatic, but
yeah, I don't think that it's a manual, but like, I don't know enough about sports cars. Jeeps though, I could do a 5-minute PowerPoint presentation on.
Nice reference. So isn't that what you're doing if you ever get invited to a party where you have to do a 5-minute PowerPoint as a condition of attending the party?
I told my dad, I was like asking my sisters like what they would do it on. And Tori was like, I would obviously do it on Tunnel Girl. Do you know?
I don't know.
Oh my God. Okay. That's an offline conversation. I will tell you afterwards. Okay, but my dad is like, why would you go to a party that like you had to give PowerPoints at? And I'm like, oh, it's like fun. My dad's like, nothing about that is fun. He was like, no, absolutely not. He was like, but why? And I was like, well, it's like an activity. And he goes, isn't drinking an activity? Like, why?
There was drinking. Like,
I was like, they're not mutually exclusive. He goes, you couldn't pay me to be at a party that someone was giving a PowerPoint at. And I was like, fair. Honestly, Dad, fair. You got to know your limits.
Yeah.
From PowerPoints to TV specials?
Sure, why not? Obviously, this episode gets its name from The Day After, and we're going to save, I think, most of this conversation for Bard Nostalgia, and our Gen X correspondent, John Keller, is going to chime in indirectly in that part of the conversation. But, like, I think the thing that stuck out to me the most about this particular scene was the way it was narratively structured to like knit all of the characters together.
Yes.
Where we get like the blended family, the blended FBI, KGB family all hanging out together, right? Stan and Matthew are over at the Jennings.
Yes.
With Henry and his fucking bowl of popcorn to be like, let me Stephen Colbert popcorn meme this one, to nuclear destruction and devastation of the entire world. So like we get that, and that alone I think would have been interesting. It's like a very wholesome take on the apocalypse, but then we also get William alone, very notably watching The Day After, and then we get Oleg and Tatiana like watching from bed together, and Danielle was like, hell yes, I got that when that happened.
Nailed it.
Success for the dossier, which we'll get into more further. So it's just like A, the bringing together of the Soviet family and the American family, but then, like, the broader kind of a knitting together of all of the characters, who, including ones who don't actually know each other or know of each other, in this one kind of centralizing place. And for, like, the real not quite great book heads in the audience, it reminds me a lot of the final scene of season one of The Young Pope, with Lenny's final speech, where they do a, like, here are a bunch of minor characters from all throughout, or characters who, like, were here for 6 minutes there, or 3 minutes and 4 minutes there, and they're all watching Lenny's final speech before he collapses. Spoilers. Sorry.
It's fine.
So anyway, those are my thoughts on the like function of The Day After here.
Yeah, and I will just echo that, like, the knitting together, which you have, like, really helpfully identified, was also something that I picked up on. And I think, like, for me, it is often easy to forget how all of these characters are functioning within the same universe. Like, we're often seeing, like, either interactions or like alienated forms of interaction, like a few like go-betweens between these characters, but we are very rarely reminded of how, like, they are all in this, like, very particular geopolitical moment. And I think, like, The Day After serves the function in knitting them together to remind us that, like, world events are happening and affecting all of them. It's not just about, like, Martha, like, the Philip Martha stuff. It's not just about, like, all of these, like, what feel like separate pieces here and there. It, like, they all do get, they come together because of the way the world exists. And that's, like, the subject matter of The Day After, like, as Elizabeth says, right, is sort of, or is, like, the very, it's, like, the very fabric that keeps, that drives them to do what they do.
It is, and that's a useful way to put it, because I think of the conversation that Paige and Philip have about The Day After, where that's emblematic of some of the points we've raised about this episode as a whole, right? Because Philip's ambivalent sense of obligation or identification is on display there, because Paige presses him after Philip gives the, like, standard line that he and Elizabeth have given Paige many versions of that we've seen thus far, that, like, we do what we do to keep that from happening, like, to keep the world safe, to keep peace, promote peace, whatever. Paige, of course, like, presses the question, like, she puts the question to them of whether that's bullshit or actually true. She says it more nicely, right? But she asks, does it make a difference? Philip gives the honest answer, honest-ish answer, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? But, like, given that this is the episode in which he and William and Elizabeth are debating whether or not to actually tell the center about Lassa virus, actually, he seems to be thinking that maybe actually we're not making the world any safer, and in fact making it a whole hell of a lot more dangerous. So there's that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a way in which, like, what you've identified reflects on Paige's experience here, because she's like, well, I hope we're all together and I hope it happens quickly. I've got more thoughts on Paige. I'm going to save it for theory ship.
I love it. I think with that, we have come to the end of the main discussion. We can jump on into the dossier.
Yes, the floor is yours. You took a major L last time, Danielle, but you have reversed course.
Major L last time. Martha, still alive. For now.
in Moscow, 7 months later.
In Moscow, hanging out. But I will say, I did call Tatiana and Oleg, like, going to the bone zone, and I'll take that as a victory.
I demand that that's the only terminology that you are allowed to use for any two characters who fuck for the entirety of Not Quite Great Books, the Americans, and all other aesthetic endeavors.
Okay.
Of the cinematic or TV variety.
I'll take that obligation. Oh, Pastor Tim. Still alive, sadly, although I do think that, like, with the pseudo threat to Philip, I think his time is coming to an end. So maybe he will soon be not just a figurative ghost, but an actual ghost.
Victorian ghost Tim.
I hate him. I hate him. I hate him so much. I was trying to not, like, theorize death in this episode, but I was like, Pastor Tim, you like really have it coming for you. You can't threaten a spy.
It's funny how you like want the like hypothetically more like coded as innocent characters to die. Martha, we got fucking rid of her. Pastor Tim, what a shithead. We have to send him to the death zone.
Listen, Martha, I just think narratively for a long time it made sense for her to die. Pastor Tim sucks. And like, it's a different story. You have some questions for me?
I do have questions for you. I have several questions for you. Do you want to start with the more or less serious question?
Less.
Okay, Danielle, you're on record as like being hardcore on the Glanders denialism.
Yes.
What's your status of alternative medicine and just asking questions about the Lassa virus?
Not real. Not real. Also, when William is like, it makes the blood come out of their skin, it's like, where else is blood going to come out of? Like, get out of here. Stop trying to make this a zombie movie. Like, goodbye. We're World War Z over here.
Threat than Glanders.
Like, moot point, because neither are any of a threat. Please give me a rat with the Lassa virus in it. Also, what is that name, Lassa virus? Like, are we on?
That was my next question.
Are we on? Is hey, that a dude? Better?
Is that a better?
It's a little wild and a little strange.
I loved Hey Dude.
Me too.
That was one of my favorite Nick shows.
Me
of
too.
The '90s.
Hey Dude. Also loved. What was the Camp Anawana one? Salute Your Shorts.
Yep, Salute Your Shorts. I was more of a Hey Dude than a Salute Your
Same.
Shorts.
Listen, I wanted to be Brad because I was like,
don't remember any of their names.
It was the girl with the brown hair because she had a
sure.
For me at the time felt like a boy's name, but was a girl, and I like really loved that.
Okay, I support that. What's a better name or a worse name between those two?
I mean, like, let's name it with some fucking numbers, like COVID-19. Like, come on. Like, give me...
So if we called it Lassa 44, no, that'd be better?
Lassa is a dumb name. But, like, okay. Let's call it something else. I'm not going to think of a good name, but, like, give me a year number. This just seems fake.
This is my task, is that next episode, I would... of love a surprise dossier drop of better names for fake diseases in television
Great.
Shows.
I will
Power
take
Ratings
it
by Danielle Hammond.
Take it under advisement.
Thank you.
Okay, what's the more serious question?
What do you think happens next with Don and Young Hee and Elizabeth?
I mean, I wonder if I think the thing that I was trying to puzzle over in this episode was whether or not they like have enough on Don to manipulate him, because he strikes me as the kind of person who maybe tells Young Hee that this happens. And then it can't really be used against him. Right. Like, because the only way that this encounter can be used against him is if they're like if he's trying to prevent, like, I don't know, Patty or whatever, from telling her, or trying to prevent Young Hee from learning about it. And something about their relationship strikes me that, like, he would tell her.
Excellent predictions. Anything else you'd like to enter into the dossier?
No, not for now, but I am going to think through some better names for the Lassa virus.
Thank you.
Lassa is definitely a better name than Glanders, okay? Like,
oh, this is my take. You know my take is that Glanders is the ideal disease name. Now, I did learn in this episode that I would maybe like it more if it had a number attached to it, but I still think Landers is the centerpiece.
You're welcome. A+. You're welcome.
Where do you want to start in Glass this week?
Let's start with Oleg and Tatiana. One, because it's a great transition from my dossier victory, and two, correct, because like it is a kind of, it's like an interesting moment between them. We see them first. They're in the pan shot. They're watching the day after movie together,
clothed
on, but
cuddling,
but cuddling on a bed. So like,
correct,
not platonically.
They had been fucking.
Yeah,
yeah.
Or they were about to be fucking. Like, either one. Fair. And then like, they're the sex scene in this episode, and she's like, "Be quiet, be quiet." And he's like, "You're so quiet."
Okay, you skipped over the most important part, Danielle.
Which was?
Costa Ronan's O-face. Oh. Like, the exaggerated nature of the to which Costa Ronan plays his orgasm while Tatiana is on top is just like...
And is trying to shut his mouth. And
utterly comical, yes. I love it a lot. And then, like, Oleg has, like, his fussy hair afterwards. Yeah. Like, while Tatiana is like, I'm going to go get put back together, like, immediately.
Right.
Extremely, you know, like, you're using the sex scene to, like, reinforce things we know or suspect about their characters. Like, it works on that level. And I just thought it was, like, well done and effective. And I think then to, like, to make the obnoxious political theory point, Tatiana makes, like, an extreme, like, class and gender point about, like, how much noise can you have while we're having sex? Like, she clearly not from the relative, like, wealth or status that Oleg's family is. Like, Oleg's family... What's the laugh?
I just, when he's, like, sturdy walls, and he's, like, banging on the walls.
Oh, my God. I love that so much. I love this scene, and Tatiana is, like, we had a communal apartment, and, like, you know... It was like me and my boyfriend had to wait for there to be no other people from any of the families who shared a space. And that never happened. And we were quiet as mice is her line.
Quiet as mice. Yeah.
And then we're going to save more of their chat for borrowed nostalgia, I believe.
Sounds good to me. Next thing in gloss, racquetball back. We've already addressed this a little bit. We get racquetball back, but we also get this sort of exchange between Philip and Stan, which reminds us of, like, how manly they are.
Right. And, like, how disbelieving Stan is of Philip's masculinity, right? Because, like, Stan's like, you're on fire. Like, what has been happening? And Philip gets to give his line of, like, more sleep, we let some accounts go, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, this then provides the opening for Stan to emote like an actual human being. He and Tori finally officially broke up, and Stan is entering sad boy zone, of which Philip, Matthew Reese, very, very comfortable in that zone.
Very comfortable.
And so, like, they're doing the, like, most normatively masculine thing of, like, we are competing, and also that's our mode or entryway into emoting. But also, like, the racquetball is intense.
The racquetball was really intense, and, like, it was intense anyway, and then we haven't seen it for 3 seasons, and so, like, it makes it, its absence and then immediate presence, like, makes it even more intense.
Love. It made me want to play racquetball.
I've never felt that. Racquetball just feels like you're going to lose an eye. Like,
well, that's yeah, they should be wearing sports goggles.
They were not.
There's no doubt about that.
Felt stressful. I don't know how to play racquetball, which I suspect is not that hard, but I do know how to play squash.
Someone still needs to explain to me. I don't understand why those are different things, but that's okay.
Different balls and different rackets.
Fair.
And, like, different rules about where you should be standing on the, like, okay. The courts are different. You can't play. Cool. I guess you could play squash on a racquetball court, but the markings on the court are different.
Okay. Nonetheless, if anyone lives in Plattsburgh, New York, and has access to racquetball courts, hit us up.
Hit up, John.
Danielle, you know who else I think would really love a bro-y game of racquetball?
Oh, boy. Who?
Pastor Tim. I think that, like, I think that Pastor Tim should join. He's too fragile. His ghostly complexion can't handle it.
Pastor Tim does not do, like, he doesn't do strenuous physical activity.
It would fuck up his hair.
I mean, he needs his hair fucked up. So, like, I'm for it for that reason. But, like, no, he does not. He would not. He's a ghost. Like, the ball would pass through him. Like, leave it alone.
Really interesting strategical conundrum. I make that joke only to say that, like, I think it's worth dwelling slightly longer on the Pastor Tim interaction with Philip and Paige at the end of this episode, right? Not only for the dossier related reasons, but also because, like, we get to see Paige, like, how she's interacting, and, like, we get to see the jokey detente between Philip and Pastor Tim about how, like, they're each financially benefiting from this relationship. Mm-hmm. More on that coming up in theory ship. Mm-hmm. But also then there's, you called it, I think aptly, like Pastor Tim's like quasi-threat towards Philip, that like, we need to have a conversation. And I'm thinking like back to our discussion about Paige's like lack of people who are interested in her own self-directed obligation. Like, I know you hate to see it, but Pastor Tim does actually care about Paige's like sense of self and like self-direction or self-determination.
I mean,
to some extent.
Right. I would agree to some extent, but like only to the extent that it is like in line with the teachings of the church, right? So, like, I don't think that that is, like, just caring about Paige for the sake of Paige or caring about her, like, self-directed actions for the sake of Paige. It's, like, because, like, there is some kind of vested interest in Paige as a member of the church, and I don't think that that is, like, it's not, like, just a pure interest in Paige.
I buy that for sure.
So, I'm just skeptical of the church, man.
Fair.
That's why I wasn't on the Pope Lenny podcast.
Yeah, you're always welcome when we do New Pope while you're in Athens this summer.
Great.
If you go there again.
Love. I'll hop on to just like, I don't know, wax poetically about Aquinas and like yell about the church.
What is a normal episode of Not Quite Great Books, Young Pope?
Seems great.
Just fewer personal feelings and reminiscences of our youth.
All right, let's go to Park Fitz.
Please, love Park
Fitz. I just love that William was like, oh, this is the best outfit yet. Like, to Philip's disguise. I was like, okay, buddy, like, we can't just be saying that out in the open here. Like, come on, man. We're spies.
Don't worry. Like, it had been scoped out by Hans and Elizabeth, kind of, in advance. I have to say, this Philip disguise, like, was really, like, hilarious to me. I don't know if you have seen, Danielle, the, like, can't believe I'm going to do this, but, like, 1975, their, like, conceit for their tour at the moment is that they are, like, dressed up as old men in, like, an 80s sitcom, and, like, Philip's fucking costume here, his disguise, is like Mattie Healy's fucking costume at the 1975.
I have no time for Mattie Healy. He just seems like a womanizer and fucking terrible, so I'm not interested. But I do like the comparison.
No lies detected.
Yeah.
I just thought, I came through my brain.
No. Nothing. I like the comparison. With our now I have it in my brain.
Hordes of millions of listeners. Yeah.
Yikes.
Could you imagine?
I can't. It would stress me out.
True.
What else do we have going on in the park, John?
Show Hans happened.
Yes.
And Mission Show Hans, like, he's jogging. He looks great while jogging. His hat's goofy, but it was useful for him signaling to Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So Hans, he's there. He's jogging. He's spying.
Yeah, we love. Elizabeth's got a great outfit in the park.
Love her outfit and her hair and her makeup in the park.
Yeah, very, like, classy businesswoman, but in casual dress.
Like, indie casual
businesswoman. Yeah.
Like, well, self-conceptualized as indie businesswoman.
There's something about her haircut, like, the wig, that, like, gives that.
And her hat on the top of the wig.
Exactly. Was into it. Was very into it. All right, we've got some spycraft. There's obviously some spycraft happening in the park. I really wanted to have, like, I said this to you before we started recording, like, I wanted Elizabeth to, like, move a bag to another shoulder. Like, I wanted a little bit more physicality, but I liked the park spycraft.
Yeah, I did as well. I had a question for Elizabeth and her techniques at Don and Yankee's house, and that is, shouldn't she be wearing gloves when she's, like, going through his personal document and safe and, like, looking around and rooting in his office, like, because it would make sense for her fingerprints to be anywhere if in some later date that showed up, but it seems like you would want to make sure they weren't there in his office. That's the question. I'm no spy. You and I have determined that we would both be bad spies, but nonetheless, I thought this was a mistake. Maybe it's like a sign that Elizabeth is not fully in her right spycraft mind because of her emotional ties to Young Hee.
I think that's the right analysis. I guess where my brain went, which is a much more fucked up place, was if I was a spy, I would make them burn my fingertips off so I didn't have fingertips.
Okay. Some hydrochloric acid. And here's my killer reference. Danielle just ordered from Amazon all of the elements to make the acid that she needs to burn her hands off. And she'll be going to an anonymous Amazon locker in Boston to pick it up tomorrow.
Seems right. Oh my god.
Not necessarily spy craft, but the spy mindset is something that Paige is increasingly inhabiting. Like, we get, and this is another way in which the driving is functioning as a commentary on the, like, fucked up obligations or senses of self that Paige is experiencing, because at the end of the driving, like, her and Philip have potentially bonded, and she closes by being like, here's the deal with Pastor Tim. We've got this send-off event before he goes to Ethiopia, and you also need to come because Pastor Tim likes seeing us all together to think we're more normal. Right. So like Paige has fully or has internalized to a greater degree just the like I'm processing all of the things and running them through my like spy operation.
Yeah. I had that point and I totally agree with it. And it's like a little bit chilling in the way that she's like, no, guys, we all have to go. And this is why. Yeah.
Exactly. So that we all appear normal.
Right. Because that's a thing we do now.
Yeah, exactly.
What have we gotten by the way of camera shots, John? This is like your bread and butter.
So we talked about the, like, Elizabeth popping up like a horror movie or slasher movie villain earlier in the episode. But then the other camera shot that I'd point out, and this one's like a little more obvious, but I thought was amusing nonetheless. It's when Don and Patty / Elizabeth are drinking wine and Patty / Elizabeth is on one side of the counter and Don is on the other. Mm-hmm. And like they have Don like drinking wine and the camera shoots like through the circle that is created by his body turned to the side with the wine glass to frame Elizabeth and like a look of slight concern, which is like that's a little bit more of like a trick showy shot, but I thought it kind of worked.
I didn't pick up on it, but I like that. And I like the sort of like Don using Don's body to frame Elizabeth, but there being a sort of troubled look on her face when it's happening feels consistent with the rest of the episode.
Absolutely.
Listen, we've gotten to borrowed nostalgia. Like, take us in, man.
I maintain that this is the most borrowed nostalgia episode of season 4.
I think that's right. I feel like we have been sort of grasping for borrowed nostalgia things. And I think part of it is that, like, we were in the same 2 weeks for the first 8 episodes until the last, like, 10 minutes of the last episode.
It's a great point.
And so, like, we're getting a lot of the same, like, borrowed nostalgia hits, right? Because we're in the same spaces over and over again.
I think The Day After is the very clear, like, you know, headline from this. Like, it was shown on network TV in November 20th, 1983. So it checks out on the timeline in relationship to the time jump in the first part of season 4. Mm-hmm. We also had checked in with our Gen expert, John Keller.
Yes.
He'll be here soon enough. Don't worry.
Don't worry.
Listeners. And we asked him if he had any memories of The Day After that we could share on the pod. And here, I'm just verbatim going to read John Keller's text to us. Or does that seem acceptable to you?
Perfect.
Keller. Beyond terrifying for a 13-year-old boy from the suburbs, I was shook. 100% shaped my notion of what nuclear war would be like, meant to scare the fuck out of the population, reinforced mad doctrine. Imagine, completely terrifying. I was 13.
No notes, Keller. No notes.
Yeah. But, like, you know, you and I weren't there for The Day After. But, like, it's useful, I think, to have someone who, like, knows, like, about the politics and history to, like, get that kind of visceral reaction.
Yeah.
Because it, like, adds just a, like, check of reality to particularly Paige's reaction, I think, to The Day After. Like, granted, we don't get anything about Henry or Matthew's reactions to The Day After,
mm-hmm.
but I just thought it was notable. And, like, it very, 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 very much speaks to the what was understood correctly to be an escalation of the Cold War under Reagan, right? So, like, the anxieties are high. It's not quite the same as like 1950s, like duck and cover era nuclear terror, but there's a different, like, Reaganized version of it. And, like, The Day After has that historical role. And I thought that the, you know, it's obvious and a necessity for the show to do it, but they did a good job with it.
Yeah, and I think that, like, the, yeah, I, one, agree that it's, like, that the show does a good job with it, and, like, it's an effective framing tool for this episode in particular, and sort of, again, like we talked a little bit about in terms of, like, that you get, like, the shots of all of the different characters watching this, and it's something that pulls people together. After a whole set of episodes where we're really focused in on, like, one particular relationship, or like the sort of the fallout from the Martha relationship, right? Like, it's helpful to have this this zoom out moment as a reminder. And also, like, the early 80s is when, just like you're saying, is when, like, the tensions with regard to the USSR are being ratcheted up here, like, under Reagan. And so this is, I think, an effective way to communicate the how the stakes feel, like, so scary and intense and crazy. And it helps remind us of, like, why it is people are doing what they're doing.
Yeah. And I thought it was also extremely smart on their part to juxtapose The Day After with having Oleg talk about how he had heard from his father that there was, and this is a true story, right? Like, there was a Soviet, like, air command early warning detection system operator who overruled the system, which said that there were 5 ballistic missiles, presumably with nuclear weapons, from the U.S. heading towards the USSR. He overruled the system, did not tell his superiors, and then, like, essentially, like, I don't think it's particularly hyperbolic, and, like, there have been stories about this, to say that, like, he kind of prevented a nuclear, like, total war that annihilated the entire globe, because if enough people on the Soviet side thought that there were ballistic missiles coming towards them from the U.S., like, they were just launching their entire arsenal, causing the U.S. to launch the rest of their entire arsenal, because they wouldn't have fired any, actually. And, like, then you have global thermonuclear war. And so to have Oleg offer that in this particular episode in the context of The Day After, like, really roots this in something we later came to learn about the 80s.
Yeah.
And, like, so it gives us the borrowed nostalgia for the 80s hit, but, like, it works so well on the obligation question that we were discussing earlier in the historical context, because that person, whose name I'm going to look up when I stop talking and stop just ranting at Danielle, is
I'm here for it.
Like, does the thing that William wants to do with Philip and Elizabeth, right? Like, overrule, disobey, insubordinate what they're supposed to do, like, go outside the chain of command, not pass something up through the chain of command.
Yeah.
And then, so, like, there's, on that level, it works. And then, like, I was actually fine with this, like, putting a very fine point on it, where Oleg, like, wonders what he would have done in his position. Right. So, like, Oleg is like, would I have had the fortitude or the resolve or the whatever to suspect this was a glitch, a fluke, a mistake, or an error or whatever, and not pass it up? And Oleg doesn't seem sure about that, which I think is notable. And then, like, the last point that I'll make is that this opens up onto a conversation between Oleg and Tatiana that again reflects William's concerns about the, like, technological and, like, organizational capacities of the USSR itself.
Yeah, I mean, like, one, no notes, amazing. Two, I didn't know that this was something real until you put it in our notes. And so I think that just makes it more profound. And three, I think, like, the parallel between Oleg's story and, like, William's request to Philip, I think, is, like, the key point in terms of the, like, the narrative within the show, that, like, see, it's important in conversation with Philip, you, like, went against the chain of command and succeeded. And, like, this is an instance where going against the chain of command isn't about, like, a personal success. It's about a, like, global success. And, like, that could be what we're what we're dealing with. And that seems to be like what William is sort of after. It's not just like, oh, Philip, you personally were correct, but like, it is important that like we as humans like stand out and do these things.
Yeah. Excellent. So yeah, and this is again, another way that the show uses its history really effectively to comment on themes and like to entirely trivialize it. Like shouts to Stanislav Petrov, our guy who like potentially literally saved the world from nuclear annihilation. Arguably.
We're into it.
You know what else I'm into, Danielle?
What?
80s music and the Americans.
Love. Tell us what music. It's
extremely important to note that not only is racquetball back, Danielle.
Yeah.
What else is back? Yaz is back.
We love.
Yaz record.
Great.
Yes, we love a Yaz record. We're going to make a Yaz record. It's just really fun that we get Yaz here on this episode of the Americans. I think it was, if I'm remembering correctly, a Lily episode in season 2 is the first time we get a Yaz song. Here it's Winter Kills, of course. And so, like, Lily and I believe, got to sing the praises of Yaz. It's also interesting that the previous episode had a Roxy Music song, because Roxy Music and Yaz are, like, in conversation with one another, of course, in, like, our electro or synth pop of the 80s situation. So it's an apt borrowed nostalgia for a band that I enjoy a great deal and appreciate a great deal, but was not alive at the time of their creation, and it works with the vibes of the scene. So I'm totally into the Yaz situation. Thoughts on Yaz?
Listen, I'm just here for like how much nerding out you can do over the music in this show. I'm
not done yet.
I know. Oh, I know. Don't worry. But also, I've only ever heard Yaz like on this show.
Fair.
It's okay.
Actually, you might enjoy Yaz.
Listen, synth pop does feel like a thing that I generally enjoy.
I mean, like, there's elements of Harry Styles, who's just, I use, of course, is like the paradigmatic Danielle music mode, yeah, that are like indirectly in conversation with synth pop from the 80s, like British synth pop from the 80s. Cool. So
into it.
Yeah.
What other music do we have to be nostalgic for?
Oh, of course we have Major Tom by Peter Schilling. Major Tom Coming Home, in parentheses, by Peter Schilling, playing towards the end of this episode. Obviously it's a classic 80s song. Like, everyone knows the chorus, whatever. But what is funniest about this particular needle drop to me is that later on, I guess a couple of years later, it gets used as the theme song for another spy show set during the exact same time period. So, like, Deutschland 83 uses Major Tom as its theme song. I think it plays over the credits, if I remember correctly. So, it's just very funny to me that, like, apparently this song is so speaking to the vibes of 80s spy shows.
No notes, man. I don't know the other spy show. Don't know the song. Into it.
CR is a big Deutschland 83 fan. I think you might be into it.
I believe that, but it sounds like something that has subtitles, and I'm not interested in subtitles.
It is mostly in German, yeah, yes.
Not interested. And not because I am, like, only pro-English. It's just, like, usually I'm watching TV before I go to bed, and I can't have to, like, read something and pay attention.
Fair. This is, again, our differences in how we watch TV.
Exactly.
I was talking with, I saw producer Amy and Scott just a couple of days ago. And like, Amy was like, well, what's like your comfort watch these days? Like, what are you watching like to calm down before bed? And I'm like, that doesn't exist for me. The only thing I want is like Fuck Me Up Fam from my TV. And I just don't want anything else. So I have no comfort watches for you.
My comfort watch, Vanderpump Rules, Summer House, Below Deck, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, like Bravo. Bravo is my comfort watch. The Challenge.
Fair. I know what all these things are.
Listen, I want trash inside my eyeballs. Like, that's what I want. You want Fuck Me Up Fam, and I'm like, give me the trashiest of the trash.
And apparently the Americans fits halfway between
these. No, this sites. Is a project that we are doing together. This is different.
Would you have ever watched The Americans in a separate universe in which, like, we are friends and I'm like, I love this show. It's really, really good. It's not quite as prestige-y as, like, the prestige TV that you you don't like or, like, turns you off?
Maybe if it was, like, deep pandemic and I needed a show to watch.
Fair.
Like, this is, I really like this show, but, like, a show that you have to, like, spend a lot of time thinking about is generally not a show that I'm interested in watching.
I think you deny our possibilities to say that we could do 2 hours on any of the shows that you just listed.
We, because it's you and I, we could do 8 hours on all of those shows. No, but they, like, they're not
each
as...
canonical thinker...
They're not as meaty. Like, I'm just like...
What would Machiavelli think about Scandoval? What would Wollstonecraft think about Scandoval? What is Locke's take on Scandoval?
Yeah, it's just a comps question.
What is
question.
Freud's take on Scandoval, et cetera, et cetera.
Just a comps question.
Exactly. That's our not quite great books comps, yes.
All right, let's keep going.
I've been rambling for a long time in Bard 80s. Danielle, tell us about 80s technologies.
Well... There's the, like, as you said earlier, there's the porn on the mislabeled videotape, but also that it's, like, a videotape of porn that's kind of, like, hidden in the back of Don's cabinet. That feels very 80s. And then also we've got, like, giant cordless phones in this episode. So I feel like the tech is reminding us that we are firmly in the 80s in both cases.
Yeah. We didn't get a cordless phone until, like, sometime in the mid-90s in the McMahon household. So, like, after they had shrunk down to a, like, appropriate size.
My grandparents had a cordless phone, and, like, we didn't similarly, like, until, like, mid-90s.
Yeah.
Now my parents' house doesn't even have a phone, so it's just everybody has their cell phones.
Parents still have a landline, and I don't know why, because I've literally haven't seen them answer a landline in 15 years.
Amazing.
So I think it's also worth calling out the fits that Philip and Stan have chosen to play racquetball in.
Yeah.
All that's missing are the headbands, but, like, otherwise, the shorts, the colors, the, like,
stripes.
Fabrics of the shirts, the stripes, exactly. They've got that on lock. I want to give a special shout out to the water bottles that they are drinking out of, because definitely, like, I had my parents' old-ass water bottles from the 80s that were exactly, like, no differences, those water bottles that, like, I took to, like, fucking baseball practice in 1994.
I love that. I love that.
That were from 10 years prior, so.
I love that. I want to talk for a minute about the fake Patty apartment, and in particular,
please,
the, like, light florals slash, like, Laura Ashley, like, design scheme of all of the fabrics and things.
Wallpaper, yeah.
The couch, like, very 80s, very, like, mentioned as a description in a Babysitter's Club book from the 80s, like, Laura Ashley Sweet. Vibes.
Extremely 80s apartment, extremely 80s, like, as we've commented on, the disguise of Patty just functions in that way for Elizabeth to, like, fully embrace the 80s-ness. And I think the clothing item that reminded me of that this time is the jacket that she's wearing and the pattern of her jacket. And that it's, like, navy instead of black.
And it's,
all of those things are saying 80s to me.
We also, generally with Elizabeth, when she's not in spy gear or, like, in a disguise, rather, her clothes are not tight, but they are fit well, like,
yes,
and always, and this is a in particular, the Patty outfits are, like, oversized in a very, like dramatic 80s fashion.
I think that, like, Oyeg smoking after sex, I think I comment on every time, just it seems very, like, Soviet 80s to me.
Yeah, and I think just, like...
I don't have any, like, first-hand experience of that, but, like, that's just my assumption.
I think just, like, smoking inside, smoking in one's bedroom does feel very 80s. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, that was a very deep dive into borrowed nostalgia for the truly unremembered 80s.
Unremembered, because
except
this,
for John Keller.
This is before you and I were born. It's roughly a month before
Danielle,
I'm born.
It's That's true. That's true. You're coming soon, Daniel Hanley.
Oh my God. At this point, my parents don't know if I'm a girl or a boy, so they picked a name that could go both ways.
It's nice. Nice. Minor character time?
Yeah. I think it's the kids. It's the...
I fully agree.
It's the kids. They... First of all, you have dropped the names in. So Casey Lee plays Sarah.
It's an IMDb find.
Zach Lee plays Bobby. Blythe Sim plays Sue. You could not pay me to have remembered the names of these children, but...
I would have gotten Sue.
I mean, that's impressive. I would not have gotten any one of them. But they, like... Listen, they go to bed on time. They don't...
They love pizza.
They love... I mean, same. They love pizza. They go to bed on time. They don't catch Elizabeth snooping in their father's stuff. Like, that's it. They're well-behaved. So they're the minor character of the week.
I support that move fully. And I think, Danielle, it's time for the cave.
Oh, it's time for the cave. We are still in Play-Doh season. But on my request, we are in a...
Is season 5 also going to be Play-Doh season?
I want season 5 to be like Derrida season. Or something like unhinged.
Danielle, you know we have a record of taking these jokes extremely seriously on the Not Quite Great Books podcast. I think you just committed us to 13 episodes of Derrida.
No.
And I have mixed feelings
about that. It's not that I want it to be Derrida, but I do like the idea of sticking with a thinker for, like, the entire season. So maybe we think about which thinker we want it to be. Derrida was just the most unhinged thinker that came to my brain.
Well, I definitely think we should push into unhinged territory.
Oh, totally.
As if... Connect every platonic dialogue to the Americans is not itself unhinged.
John and I were trying to, like, I was like, okay, we can't do the Republic because we've done the Republic too many times, which isn't to say that we won't do the Republic again, but I was like, I need a difference. And you were like, we just did something different. Let's go back to the Republic. And I was like, no, we have to go to the laws. And then I spent roughly 40 minutes trying to find an electronic copy of the laws that had Stephanus numbers. And John's like, we could just do the Republic. And I was like, no, we have to do the laws. John's like, well, it's like pretty random anyway. Like, we just like find a passage in the Republic. I'm like, no, the laws is not random. I like became very militant about my Play-Doh.
Yeah. Look, is that, Danielle, you usually accuse me of being a Platonist. Here I'm going to accuse you of being a Platonist.
Oh, you're a Platonist about culture. I am a Platonist.
Platonist about Plato. Yeah,
and I feel fine about that. All right, so we are in the laws. This is the last dialogue that was ostensibly written by Plato. There's some...
I thought The Statesman was ostensibly the last dialogue written by Plato, so...
I think the laws is the
Oh, no, I have no doubt that you are correct about this.
This is also a dialogue where sometimes people are like, did Plato even write this? Like, question mark. It's a real conspiracy theory in the political theory world.
Wikipedia does say last and, crucially, longest dialogue.
Yeah, well, this dialogue is so long. Too many pages. All right, I'm scrolling. Tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay, give me a letter.
E.
Okay. Next, he must instruct the citizens that all his directives to them have these goods in view, the human goods directed at the divine, and the divine ones at intelligence, their leader. When the citizens join together in marriage, when they beget and raise children, male or female, when they are young, as they mature and reach old age, he must take care to mete out, honor, and censure correctly. He must scrutinize carefully the citizens' pains, pleasures, desires, and the general intensity of their passions as they associate with one another, and he must use the laws themselves as instruments of correct praise and blame.
Danielle, look at us. You correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about with the laws. To me, this sounds like it's a passage about political obligation, but obligation about, like, what kinds of cultural and affective and political education is the ruler, the lawgiver, obligated to give the citizens? And then what happens in return? Like, what is the reciprocity that is, like, being generated in those obligations? And so, like, when we think about the marriage and children stuff, like, in the Americans verse, obviously we are considering – can't believe I just dropped that phrase unselfconsciously, and I hate myself for it. So in the Americans, like, I think there's a question about, okay, when – Elizabeth and Philip were married, like, what is the role of the state in that marriage? Mm-hmm. And what does the state bestow upon them? What do they give in turn to the state? How does that shape the relationship between them? When we talk about the begetting of children in this passage, obviously we have the question of, like, to what and to whom is Paige obligated by virtue of her birth? So, like, this is a very obvious connection of our random theory journey into the cave to our theme we chose for this episode, but I'm sticking with it. It's my story.
No, honestly, like, that's spot on. No notes. I'm, like, laughing a little bit because the rest of this quote is, As for feelings of anger and fear that disturb the soul on account of misfortune and of relief and good fortune, the sorts of feelings people have in illness, war, poverty, and their opposites, he must define and teach what is fine and what is not in each person's condition. So it's like, yeah, in a lot of ways, it's like how the way the affective or the emotional complicates the otherwise, like, structured and ordered, right? Which I think is also, like, a theme that we've touched on throughout this episode. I think the other thing, too, just, like, to your point about Philip and Elizabeth's marriage and the beginning of children and all of that, and, like, the way the state structures the obligations, I think, like, the thing that is interesting and complicated here is that, on the one hand, right, they are married and they are made to serve the Soviet state. And also, yeah, they exist in and are under the purview of the American state. And it's like, brilliant, the tension between those things also, like, explodes sometimes in really deadly ways, like the day after. And sometimes in these more, like, banal or ordinary crises, right? Like the stuff with Paige in the kitchen. And so I think, like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, especially because a lot of the sources of conflict between Philip and Elizabeth is from where and from what does kind of their marital bond originate?
Yeah.
Right? And, like, how do we think about that in terms of the Soviet state, the American state, and the relationship between the two of, yeah, them? As independent of that as one could possibly make it. And obviously for them, it's not that independent.
Yeah.
But, like, that's that, the differing answers, the, like, conflicts that those being pulled in multiple directions generates is, like, I think one of, if not the root source of conflict between the two of them, and, like, all of the fights that they have had, including the one that we saw them have in the previous episode.
No notes.
Good job. Good job by
Listen,
us.
Listen,
the laws. Who knew?
Who knew?
Not me.
Not definitely me. Not you.
Danielle knew.
I was just I think the laws is where we need to go for this. And it was. It was.
Yeah.
I mean, it
never been wrong.
Listen, it helps that the laws is often read as the sort of, and this is not exactly the like interpretation that I would offer, but, like, it's often interpreted as the, like, the practical application of the ideas in the Republic, right? So there's a certain continuity between the things we've been talking about in the Republic and the stuff that comes up in the laws. There's, like, there are differences too, but.
Yeah. Plato question for you. I actually don't know the answer to this. Is it the laws or the statesman that's understood to have, like, been shaped by Plato's time trying to be, like, the philosopher behind the ruler at Syracuse?
So, it's supposedly the laws, but then there's also a question as to, like, a question that people ask is, like, whether or not this was written by Plato,
sure,
or written by one of, yeah, his students. Because, like, another way to read the laws, like, if you read the laws as, like, as, okay, well, here, if the Republic is the city in speech, the laws is, like, the city in practice, right? And that is the Syracuse extension. but also, like, it's, some people are like, maybe this wasn't fully written by Plato. Maybe this is written by some of Plato's students. There are parts of it that, like, are a little bit more similar to, like, an Aristotle or something like that. I don't, that's not a reading that I potentially buy, but I like the idea of it.
Thank you. Like I said, I'm just going to keep using Plato season as a way to learn more about Plato from Danielle.
Listen, here we are. Let's do some theory ships before we get out of here.
Absolutely.
You start.
I will go first. I have a couple.
Okay.
First, I have one for, these are both like markers I laid down earlier. My first, and I like this one a little bit more, so I'll do this one first, is I have some theory shipping to Paige.
Okay.
And I'd like to give Paige the book Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet, : Ghosts and Monsters of the Anthropocene.
Okay.
So that's an edited volume, a very creative edited volume by Anna Singh, Heather Swanson, Elaine Gahn, and Niels Boubant.
Okay.
And that's a, like, book that is interested in, like, the aesthetic and ethical and cultural practices in, we can contest the term Anthropocene, but Anthropocene. And it's, like, very much how do we deal with, like, it's there literally right in the title. Mm-hmm. Like, they talk about the ghosts of the Anthropocene and the monsters of the Anthropocene. So there's some temporality stuff that's happening here. There's some hauntology that's happening here. Daniel's favorite. And so I think that in an episode where Paige is, like, shook to her core by the day after and is, like, a little bit asking these questions of, like, how do we live in, like, with the day after as a possibility, one of the things I was thinking about while watching the episode earlier today was that there's something about Paige's, like, affective response to the day after that resonated with some of the conversations I had with my students.
Oh, interesting.
In environmental political thought this past semester and environmental ethics, like a semester or a year and a half ago, this was three semesters ago, about the, like, what does it mean to, like, live and what are our kind of modes of affective and political relationality to, like, climate catastrophe or climate doom or something like this. And, like, we had a really good conversation actually about that Damaged Planet book. And so I thought that would be relevant for Paige.
I like it. I like it. I think that I also want to theory ship something for Paige, and not exactly along the same lines, but I was thinking a little bit about,
and I've got a second one, Danielle, if I may.
You may.
All right. So I was thinking about this really hilarious moment in the conversation between Tim and Philip, where Pastor Tim is about how, like, you keep getting us such a great deal on the travel, like you did it for Kenya, which apparently actually happened, Danielle. The Kenyan trip happened and Pastor Tim did not die.
Sad.
But for Kenya, the travel DuPont Circle Travel Agency came through, did so again for Ethiopia. And Philip is like, you and the church are great for business. And I would like to point out that while this is not an evangelical church, as far as we know, this is like cool Methodists or something. That's how they understand themselves or whatever the fuck. It's an early premonition of what William Connolly would later call the evangelical capitalism resonance machine in an article from, like, the early aughts.
Nice.
And, like, that is being prefigured here in the quote unquote hip church travel agent capitalism resonance machine of Philip and Pastor Tim. So I'm assigning William Connolly to both Pastor Tim and Philip. They can have a Bible study group of Bill Connolly.
I mean, I'm always pro Bill Connolly anything, so I'm into that. I've got a theory ship for Paige, which is, like,
oh yeah, I can't,
maybe wait, a little weird, but I think, like, interesting.
Here's this fucking book about how fucked we are in the Anthropocene. Here you go, Paige. That's normal. Well, that's having a normal one.
Yeah. I mean, like, what is normal? Question mark. But I want to.
Foucault has something to say about that.
The first episode this season where we haven't theory ship Foucault.
That might be true.
I want to theory ship Paige a little bit of Sadia Hartman's Scenes of Subjection.
Okay.
Because I think that this book offers, it's not thinking explicitly about obligation, and yet it is, like, completely thinking about the sort of, like, the terrible side of obligation and like what obligation does not only to the body, but to like Black women's bodies, like through like within systems of domination and oppression. Right. And so I think that I feel like this would just be like educational for Paige. And also it like, it might make her stop moping a little bit, like, about how terrible her life is that she, like, has to go to, like, church group. It's like, yeah, okay, and, like, get up, sit up.
I support this in all ways for Paige as a theory ship. Great call.
Amazing. Well, John, I believe we've come to the end of this episode.
Yeah, how do we do on your hour 30 project?
We are over, but, you know, it was a good conversation, so I did not try to bully us into making it. We're at an hour and 45.
Thank you for letting me fully indulge all of my 80s Barb nostalgia.
Listen, you've got the attention to detail that I just like have no ability for, so I can't begrudge you.
It'd be nice if I could bring that to almost any other area of my life. It's like it's only here for the Americans Not Quite Great Books podcasting with Danielle, and that's about it.
Listen, I love it. I like that I get to benefit from it. Is that wrong? Oh my God. Well, thank you as always to producer Amy. And up next in 2 weeks in the feed, you'll have American season 4, episode 10, Munchkins.
Yeah. Do you think, Danielle, this is a late breaking Danielle dossier. Do you think it's about Dunkin' Donuts Donut Holes Munchkins?
Oh, no. I was going to say, there better be, like, the Lollipop Guild in this from The Wizard of Oz. Like, and we represent the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop Guild.
You know I love an episode where Danielle sings, even if it's a minute and 40 plus 8.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books.
A TV podcast. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. It's created by Danielle Hanley and John McMahon, and indirectly, producer Amy. You can find us on Twitter at NotGreatBooksTV. You can email us at NotGreatBooksTV@gmail.com. If you have comments or questions that we might potentially read and respond to on air, subscribe, download, rate, review us, tell your friends to find us at Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. We would like to thank Less FM for Electro Trend 60s, which is the music that you heard at the beginning and you are hearing right now. Until next time. Go play some racquetball.